You've been waiting a long time, not just for this concert, but at this concert. You're at Madison Square Garden in New York City on the 27th of November, 1969. You've seen Terry Reid, B.B. King, and Ike and Tina Turner, but the headliners have not yet appeared. What happens next will become the history-making album, Get Your Ya-Ya's Out.
That's the moment I remember, you know, them coming out on stage. The music, as sometimes is the case at a concert, they could have played the phone book because I was just seeing their sense of being on stage.
That show at Madison Square Garden was truly amazing.
I was impressed by the ferocity of it. I didn't expect that. I suppose I expected kind of a polite British band, but it was absolutely ferocious.
It just felt like, God, this is really what rock and roll is all about.
The Rolling Stones were nearing the end of their first American tour in nearly 3 years. Since their last visit, the group had released 5 top 5 albums and classic singles including Jumping Jack Flash, Street Fighting Man, and Honky Tonk Women. The anticipation was palpable. Besides, New Yorkers were in a mood to celebrate. It was the Thanksgiving holiday, and hardly anybody had to be up early the next day anyway. So the crowd generously waited, unaware that backstage it was an anxious time for tour organizer Ronnie Schneider.
The funny thing is, in reality, for Get Your Ya-Ya's, people might have been just listening to blank sound, because originally there was no deal at the Garden. They'd never sent the contract back. And the day when I arrived in New York, I got the report that they were changing the entire deal, and the Stones had to quit performing by midnight. They said if the Stones played 1 minute past midnight, they'd have to pay $20,000 in overtime union costs at the Garden. So when I went into the Garden that day after the sound check to finally get a deal, there was nobody there. And just after Ike and Tina went off, the announcement that I was going to make at that time was the Rolling Stones have left the building. The Madison Square Garden doesn't care about its fans. They refuse to pay us. Go at it. So just before that was about to happen, the Garden officials came backstage and we met amongst the elephant droppings from the circus and made the deal.
And that's literally true because the circus plays the Garden.
Yes.
Well, that's pretty close to the edge there. Did you have nerves of steel in those days?
Well, I had told the Stones, please don't come out. Don't go out. Don't go out. You got to stay backstage because that's my leverage. And they basically, when we're ready, we're going out. So it was a gamble between them and the Garden before we got our deal. As it is, we got the deal we wanted. 3 shows, I got a giant percentage, which had never been done before at the Garden, and I made them pay me in cash the next day.
The Rolling Stones' 1969 American tour was time to promote their new album, Let It Bleed. It was a period of transition for them. It was their first set of dates without guitarist and original member Brian Jones, who had drowned 4 months earlier at the age of 27. Mick Taylor took his place. It was also a period of change for the group in a business sense. It was their first sweep through the States without Alan Klein as manager. Mick Jagger's personal assistant at the time was Joe Bergman.
We knew we wanted to do a tour of America, and we had to wait until Mick finished Ned Kelly, which he did immediately after the Hyde Park concert. He flew to Sydney jail the next morning to be filmed, and then we had to try and figure out how we were going to organize something in America, which was planned for the fall to promote Let It Bleed. So that was all hands on deck, really, and Alan Klein was handling their business affairs, and things weren't going remarkably well. And Ronnie Schneider, who had been the tour manager in the previous 66 tour, and who was Klein's nephew, was planning to leave his employ. And we all felt that we couldn't work without Ronnie. So at that point, and that was end of September, if you can believe, I was dispatched to New York to meet Ronnie and to talk to this lighting person that everybody was raving about, Chip Monk.
Joe got Ronnie Schneider on board, but it was a difficult decision for him.
In fact, I had told Mick before I agreed to do the tour that I wanted him to get Alan's approval because I didn't want to have family problems.
It would take a while before Uncle Alan was reconciled with Ronnie, but meanwhile, the tour had to be arranged.
I had asked friends of mine who they would recommend to stage the tour, and friends of mine in America, and they had said, well, you have to meet Chipmunk, because he was at Woodstock. He was, in fact, the voice of Woodstock.
The brown acid that is circulating around us is not specifically too good. It's suggested that you do stay away from that. Of course, it's your own trip, so be my guest.
Chipmunk wasn't just the voice of Woodstock, which had happened 3 months before. He had been responsible for the festival's stage and lighting. Monk then moved on to shows for Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills and Nash at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. In the 1960s, lighting and effects were not yet an integral part of rock concerts.
This was the beginning of large stage touring. Now we take everything for granted, but this was the very beginning. And Chip was just such an extraordinary character. Looked somewhat like a lion and endlessly gracious and courteous. And I thought that Mick and Keith and everybody would love him.
I got on a flight and managed to get this rented house that Stephen still had loaned the Stones.
My job was to get to California and find homes for everybody and set up rehearsal space. In fact, for Mick Taylor, Mick Jagger, and Keith, we borrowed Stephen Still's house. Poor guy, he just had to vacate.
I asked Mick if he would come outside. Let's go to the poolside and let me spread my drawings out and I'll explain to you what I'd like to do. So I spread them all out. We started to talk about it, and I saw, I watched his eyes glaze over, and there was very little interest in it. And then all of a sudden, the wind came, blew up, and all the drawings went in the pool. And he said, looked at me and said, effing do it. Just do it.
My name's Sam Cutler. I was a former tour manager for the Rolling Stones on their famous or infamous American tour in 1969.
Did you know going into the tour that there would be a live album?
No, and in fact, the very thought of it, if anyone had suggested it at the beginning of that tour, I think would have been risible, to tell you the truth. The band was not very good. So a live album, highly improbable.
Now, when you said the band weren't very good, I presume that's a reference to the fact that they had not been on the road since 67.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the Hyde Park gig that they did in July, I don't think anyone had played, really, for 2 or 3 years, you know. And they had a new member in Mick Taylor, so they were dreadfully out of tune and all over the place. I mean, Mick Taylor famously said, you know, he was amazed that the Rolling Stones were as good as they were because they didn't even know how to, you know, tune their guitars. So right at the beginning of the American tour, they were in very, very rough shape. I mean, I can remember when we first got to LA, we went and played a gig in Colorado. It was dreadful. And we came back to LA and there was a period of time, 10, 12 days before the tour proper started. During that time period, they went from being dreadful to being fantastic. They're a very human band, you know, Paul. You get this sense of them struggling and working hard to get it together and bring it to a certain space, and then it becomes magic.
It was the first extended period of time with Mick Taylor.
Mick Taylor had only made the single Hyde Park appearance with the Stones before touring the States. Now he found himself in Madison Square Garden in front of 16,000 American fans.
Mick Taylor went from, you know, zero to 250 miles an hour in 6 seconds or something. I mean, it was just insane. For him, it was a tremendous achievement, I think.
My name is Glyn Johns. I was the recording engineer for this project and actually ended up producing it.
Bearing in mind that you'd worked with Brian Jones beforehand, was there anything from your point of view that was different?
Brian Jones' influence on the band at the beginning was massive. Unfortunately, as time progressed, he became more and more awkward to work with based on the fact that he got more and more involved with substances various, and so his input to the band musically became less and less. So when eventually he left the band and was replaced by Mick Taylor, it was rather like somebody cleaning the windshield, you know. Mick Taylor arrives. He's an extraordinarily accomplished musician. He was really the first lead guitar player, because neither Brian nor Keith were really lead guitar players. So all of a sudden you had somebody who was capable of playing solos, if you like. He had a remarkable sound, which worked brilliantly with the Rolling Stones. I think he added an extraordinary colour to the band that enabled the band to continue and broaden their audience dramatically.
The tour party in 69 was small. Photographer Ethan Russell was there. You were one of only 16 people in the core party of the Rolling Stones tour in 1969, and 16 people isn't enough to fill a tour bus.
It was an extraordinarily small tour. I mean, it was arguably and truly the largest rock and roll event, the biggest thing since Woodstock, certainly. And yet the actual group of people that went around America were on commercial airlines part of the time. They were on, rent-a-cars. Occasionally we would get a chartered plane, but it was very low-key. There were, like you say, there were 16 of us, and five of those were Rolling Stones. So if you take them out of it, there were only 11. Smaller than the makeup department of today, a friend of mine said, the thing about that tour that was, people take it for granted, but was incredibly revolutionary, was that Mick and the Stones were paying the other acts, which had never happened. The rock and roll band had not sort of packaged its own tour. They traveled with their own stage. They traveled with their own lighting. So they were really doing something that had never been done. And they weren't as known for that. They were considered to be the bad boys of rock, not the efficient boys of rock. And they did a good job, especially considering how small it was.
The majority of talent has no idea about what to do about business. But Mick Jagger, absolutely, besides the fact that he went to the London School of Economics, was brilliant. At least he knew how and what to do to keep this band going and have money. In the earlier tours, they would give a flat guarantee. The Stones would appear, and the local promoter would put in every act that they wanted that they managed in town. 69, we changed all that.
You had B.B. King, and you had Terry Reid and Ike and Tina Turner, which must have been the Stones' choices.
Yes, and Chuck Berry we had in some dates. It was the show they wanted the people to see and that they would want to watch.
You got a lot for your money.
Today, Lenny Kaye is esteemed for his long stint as guitarist in Patti Smith's band. In 1969, he was a noted rock journalist covering another group.
The ticket prices were an amazingly high $7.50, which provoked outrage. But small price to pay for the music that I love. It was really exciting to be there, not even just for the Stones, because I also got to see Ike and Tina Turner, who were fantastic, and I got to witness Terry Reid, the only time I would ever see him, and to me, he's one of the great might-have-been tales of British rock.
The singer-guitarist Terry Reid was promoting his own self-titled LP, which would be the highest placed of his three chart albums. Tina Turner was joined on the Madison Square Garden stage that night by Janis Joplin. Backstage, Jimi Hendrix, Leonard Cohen, and Leonard Bernstein mingled. This was the place to be. Mike John was there, reviewing the concert for the New York Times.
Tina, of course, was amazing. She didn't stand in one spot and gyrate. She sort of ran back from one side of the stage to the other, as does or did Mick. She was a good lead-in for that. And I remember sitting and thinking, well, God, the Stones are never going to surpass this. But they certainly did.
I think I bust a button on my trousers. Hope they don't fall down. You don't want my trousers to fall down now, do you?
Mike John's review mentions that the Stones went on 3 hours later than scheduled. It was not because of the length of the support acts. Chip Monk had previously staged not just Woodstock, but the Newport Folk and Monterey Jazz festivals. He was accustomed to building lighting rigs over days or weeks that then stayed in place for a number of shows. Designing lighting for a tour of one-nighters was something he'd not done before. Nobody had.
There were a lot of back-to-backs, and my design was really faulty, trying to build a truss on site and then, with block and tackle, raise the truss to its appropriate position for backlight. Bad design, totally unprepared for one-nighters.
Monk thought he had the problem sorted for the Madison Square Garden show.
They were very thoughtful. the IA union, which is a theatrical stagehand, was thoughtful enough to say, send us your plot and we'll hang the show for you. And all you have to do is plug the board and label it when you get here. When I got there, everything was absolutely in the wrong place. So we took it down, rehung it, and the show went up at 11 o'clock. And the second show, I think, at about 2 a.m.
Hence the apology for delay heard at the start of the record. The man making the apology and introducing the Stones was Sam Cutler.
You are the first person to popularize this expression, ladies and gentlemen, the world's greatest rock and roll band, the Rolling Stones. Was this ad lib the first time you said it, or had you thought it through?
How it came about, Paul, was we were flying to that first gig I mentioned in Colorado, and Ronnie Schneider suddenly said, hey, you know what, we've got nobody in to introduce all the bands, and Mick said, oh, well, Sam will do it. And I remember a couple of rehearsals before we went to Colorado, and there was a couple of gorgeous blondes standing there in this empty hall while the band played, and I turned around to these two blondes who happened to be twins. Say, well, what do you think of it? You know, they went, oh, they're the greatest rock and roll band in the world. Afterwards, Mick walked off and he was furious. He said, I want to talk to you. He said, come in, you know, let's go in the dressing room. So we went in the dressing room, just me and him. And he looked at me, he was really upset. He said, hey, man, don't call us the greatest rock and roll band in the world. You know, it's embarrassing and all that. And I just looked at him, I said, listen, man, either you are or you ain't. And by the time we got to Madison Square Garden, Mick had graciously accepted the accolade, and there we are.
Now, on the album, we have two Chuck Berry numbers and one Robert Johnson. And this is quite touching to me, really, because it shows that not only do the Stones continue to be a blues band as they started, but they're happy to be seen as such.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, in general, the Rolling Stones have never been given sufficient credit for the amount of energy and effort they've put into popularising black music or the blues in general. And they've got soul, you know, for sure. And, yeah, their version of Love in Vain is fantastic. When the train
The Stones were paying tribute to the fact that this was where they came from, but they were very much of a modern band. Their renditions were not nostalgic at all. It wasn't like, hey, kids, here's an oldie but a goldie for you.
You know, they adored those acts and supported them. When we'd go into the South, it was even support in a better way. I mean, in the South, sometimes they wouldn't let us go into the dressing rooms of the black talent, and the Stones would always ignore all that and go in. We'd get in trouble with the police constantly backstage.
Now, when it comes to the Garden, presumably you're on near local turf for you personally. Did you feel this was a good place for them to play?
I love the Garden, and that's when the deal started with the Garden, I thought we could do four shows there. That's how big and the fan support I always saw in New York. But the Garden said, oh, no, we can only do two, and that's why we had to have a renegotiation. They eventually went for three. The two sold out immediately, and then they went to the third, and that sold out. So the Garden, to me, was always the Rolling Stones.
The track on the album that is the surprise attraction is Midnight Rambler, because that was not a hit single. It was over 6 minutes on the original album. Now it's over 9 minutes long. Why do you think this worked in concert?
Because it was so sexy. At one point, he would rip off his big belt in those days. It was, you know, 3-4-inch thick belts, and then smash it across the stage as he'd be laying down, and the audience would be up in their seats trying to stand up and look and see where he is as he's laying on the stage, smacking the stage with the sounds of the Midnight Rambler. It just was a live audience happening. It's
not one of those. When I think of that concert, my visual is Mick on his knees. You heard about the midnight. Whap! And taking his belt and whacking it on the stage. Very, very, very powerful image.
Everything was pretty easy at the beginning of the set, and then it would start to crank up. By the time we hit Midnight Rambler, at that cue, everything else went out except all 7 or 8 arc lamps or follow spots all on him and red as he's down on his knees on the floor. And the only way you know whether or not a cue's worked is you can audibly hear from the audience as they suck in their breath, right? So every now and then during a show, we know we made it.
The lighting helped heighten the drama on stage, but the key figure in the Rolling Stones live presentation was the group's supreme showman, Mick Jagger.
Mick was fully Mick, you know, when he came out with his American flag top hat and that kind of bodysuit with the Omega symbol on it. You could see that he was the alpha male. He was really had found his voice and knew that there was no one to equal him in leading a band.
I just remember being in awe of the power of it. Of course, Mick was, you didn't get people who danced. It was very unusual for someone to be animated on stage. What the whole progressive so-called rock thing was about being musicians and being on stage and creating, and not sort of dancing about and making a show.
Please allow me to introduce myself, why I'm a man of well-intentioned.
It's almost like this energy circuit. All of this intensity comes from the audience into one body, one very small body, and he then throws it back out to the audience. It's breathtaking. And I don't think a lot of people have that ability to work with all of that in their bodies, viscerally, the way that he does.
Jagger's athleticism posed problems for Chip Monk. Apart from his hard-to-assemble lighting rig, Chip relied on spotlights. He needed a particularly good spot operator to light Mick Jagger.
Find the two best follow spot operators in the building, and we'd play little games. Like one follow spot would try and stay on top of the other. The most unskilled would end up on Wyman because he never moved. He walks up and down stage, 4 foot up, 4 foot down, 4 foot up, 4 foot down. Maybe this is to counteract the activity on the other side of the stage. Luckily, the piano is nailed down and it can't move. Keith was as erratic as usual, and Mick was just all over the place. So this presented a bit of a challenge because you really had no idea what was going to happen next.
Mick always, at the point when he got to Little Queenie, he'd say to Chip, let's have a look at you. Come on, Chip, put the lights up. And all of a sudden, the audience would explode because everybody could see everybody. And that happened also in New York, and it was just extraordinary. And everybody who wasn't on their feet and dancing before was now.
My favorite angle still is, if ever I shoot a live concert, is to shoot from behind the stage through the musicians back at the crowd, because that's really the image that they see. And, you know, sort of structurally and compositionally, you get the energy of the audience, you get the energy of the performer.
Glyn Johns recorded audience reaction as well as music, long before recording trucks were a standard part of a tour. Johns relied on the kindness of legendary sound engineer Wally Hyder.
I'd been using his studios in San Francisco and Los Angeles quite a lot in the previous years, and I just telephoned him and said, look, what would you think about you transporting some of your gear to Madison Square Garden to do this thing with the Stones? And he was brilliant. He air freighted the gear to Kennedy Airport, and then he rented a Hertz truck, put it in the Hertz truck, drove it to Madison Square Garden and assembled it in the truck. So we had the equivalent of a mobile unit that we made ourselves, basically.
Where in the garden was this truck located?
It was parked behind the stage, so very close, really.
I know that area, having been in there when the Elton John live album was made.
Yeah.
And this is the area where, if the audience goes wild, the floor goes up and down.
Absolutely.
Did that happen?
Absolutely. I thought there was an earthquake or something. It was really strange. Being in a truck, which obviously has suspension, it amplified the movement of the floor. So I'm in there listening, concentrating like hell, all of a sudden the truck starts bouncing up and down. couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. I went to the back door of the truck and looked out, and there was nothing untoward going on, seemingly, other than the fact the audience were going bananas. It would seem that the floor is sprung in there, and when the audience all jump up and down to the same rhythm, it creates movement in the floor.
The stage was about 4.5 feet high. People could touch Jagger. They did. Jagger would play with him. I've got tons of pictures of those, not necessarily from Madison Square Garden. One in particular I know comes from the Oakland show. It was always the same stage because it traveled with us. And Mick is basically sticking his foot into the audience and people are trying to touch it. It's kind of, you know, he's playing and they're playing and it feels safe. That all ends after Altamont.
Altamont, still a code word for horror in rock and roll, was only a week away. At an open-air Rolling Stones concert at a California raceway, an 18-year-old audience member, high on methamphetamine, drew a gun during the song Sympathy for the Devil. He was stabbed and trampled to death by Hell's Angels, who had been recruited as security guards. Despite the notoriety of Altamont, which is widely considered the symbolic end of the 60s, it was never associated with the Madison Square Garden concert in the public mind. Get Your Ya-Ya's Out was issued on the 4th of September, 1970, and became the first live album to reach number one in Britain. In its own sense, it signified the turn of the decades.
To me, this concert is not only, you know, closing out the 60s, but it's saying, okay, let the 70s begin. At that time, as a young and somewhat presumptuous rock writer, I wrote, you know, an end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s piece. And I said at the time that I thought that the 70s would belong to the Stones. I mean, who's more punky than Jagger, you know, strutting across that stage? They were here to show America what the Rolling Stones were about.
It was a turning point. They had to do it. They absolutely had to do it, or else they would, you know, become Herman's Hermits or the Animals or the Faces or something like that. No, it was something I absolutely had to do, and they did it. As we, you know, say, it, American writers are full of sports cliches, but they hit the ball out of the park. And I don't know how we would say that in cricket.
I love Ya-Ya's. It just somehow captures the Rolling Stones and their intensity so well.
You know what's so wonderful about it? It's so analog. You know, it's not a waveform album. It's a blood and muscle album.